Great pleasure to welcome you to EPA's Innovative Approaches to Mining Site Remediation and Reuse Workshop. My name is Bruce Means. I'm a senior advisor to the director of the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation here in Washington, D.C. It's the program that we often call simply Superfund. We've organized this workshop to facilitate discussion between government officials from around the world, private parties, nonprofits, community advocates, and academics on current topics related to global issues in mine site remediation. We've arranged the day so that there'll be time for plenary presentations, breakout group discussions, a little more time for questions and answers, and then finally there's a good bit of time that's much less structured for individuals to network and talk about specific posters that you might see around the room here. Little background, you should know that over the last 2 days there's been a meeting of the International Committee on Contaminated Land here in this hotel. And during the meeting, the representatives from over 30 different countries have come together to talk about common land remediation challenges. Their discussions focused on four different focus areas: integrating contaminated site remediation and reuse strategies, improving technical communication and collaboration on new challenges in site remediation, improving community involvement in site remediation and reuse decisions, and then finally we had a cross-cutting theme about mine site remediation and spent a good deal of time talking about legal, social, financial, and other technical issues related to that field. Most of these government officials are here with us today, and so we look forward to a very good discussion. I know they're anxious to be involved and to hear from others that they've not had the pleasure to meet yet, and also to share their views on these issues of common interest to everyone. First, I wanted to spend a few minutes on the agenda. Just to summarize, we're going to begin this morning with three presentations of fairly general interest to all of us here to provide some context. We'll hear from EPA about its Superfund mine remediation program and priorities. Also from the Pew Trust about its campaign for responsible mining initiatives, and also from Kennecott Utah Copper about industry perspectives on sustainable mine remediation practices. These three presentations really should provide us a pretty good broad context, I think, for the more technical or specialized presentations that you'll be hearing about in some parallel tracks as we go through the day. Again, after all three of these, we'll have a short question and answer time. I think what we're going to do is ask you to make note of your questions or comments and wait for all three of our presenters to complete their work. We have, in fact, a group online now. We're streaming this morning plenary session, and by postponing the question and answer period, we'll be able to better manage the comments that come in that are typed into the system, and this is what our technical folks tell us works best. So I appreciate your patience on that, and we'll see how that goes. I mentioned that we have the plenary sessions. We have three breakout groups for today's workshop. One, building sustainability into mine site remediation. Second is innovations in mine site remediation technologies. And the third is, again, engaging communities in remediation and reuse decisions. At the end of each breakout session, there'll be some time for questions and answers, an open discussion, and then at the very end of the day, we'll all reconvene in a plenary format and hear from each of the breakout groups and have a little more time to talk about issues that may have come up. Just to emphasize, I think partly as a result of the webcasting, we'd like to ask that those making the presentations or asking the questions here in the room, be sure to speak into a microphone so that the others on the line can also participate. And I wonder if there are other technical matters related to that. For those that will be using slides, I guess Kelly in particular, if you wouldn't mind as we go from one slide to the next also to identify the slide number as we move through that. Okay. Very good. And since we care a great deal about emergency response, I'm reminded that we need to highlight the fact that if there is an emergency and we need to evacuate this room, you are encouraged to proceed out these doors, turn left, go down the stairs into the main lobby area, out to the street, move away from the building, and move to your right. So, again, if there's a need for an emergency, such as a rare occurrence like an earthquake, for example, here, you go out the doors, back down to the main lobby, out the front door, past the little bell station there, and take a right and move as far away from the building as you can. All right, very good. Next up, I'd like to introduce Barnes Johnson, who will present our welcoming address to us this morning. Mr. Johnson is the Deputy Director of the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. He's worked at EPA for over 27 years and brings a diverse background to his present position, working in a variety of EPA programs, including radiation, indoor air, solid and hazardous waste, the agency policy shop, our enforcement program, and water offices as well. Mr. Johnson began his career as a researcher at Louisiana State University, where he earned master's degrees in both wildlife and fisheries management and applied statistics. This morning, Barnes is going to speak with us about several important National Superfund program priorities as they relate to our mining workshop focus areas. Barnes?
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Welcome to everyone. I know many of you have traveled great distances to be here, and as Bruce mentioned, have been through a long week of conversation and exchange. And thank you for sticking with us to the end and being here today for a day of discussions about innovative approaches to mine site remediation and reuse. Also, I want to extend a thank you to our participants on the web. I guess we have about 50 folks that are that are listening in to us. So a welcome to them as well for taking the time out to listen into our conversation this morning. This workshop is being jointly sponsored by my office, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, as well as the International Committee on Contaminated Land. As Bruce said, it's been hard at it all week long with a lot of interesting conversations and discussions, which I hope will continue today. Let me also thank everyone here that was involved in the planning committee for this. I think we all understand that pulling together an event like this is no small task. There's an enormous number of details and tremendous amount of thought that goes into these. And for bringing together what I think is just a very impressive group of speakers and participants is again, no small task. And I'm personally very appreciative of the effort of the planning groups. I think workshops like this serve an essential purpose of bringing together people with different perspectives. We have an opportunity to share our experiences, exchange insights and information, and provide our organizations that we represent, our governments, our companies, and our nonprofit organizations, a chance to hear what others have to say, where angles people are taking, the approaches people are using, and so I think this opportunity is one that I know I'm glad we can take advantage of, and I think it will serve that purpose for all of us. I think this workshop is also really a reflection, I think, of EPA's broader commitment to looking to the international community for guidance and for collaboration on international and global environmental issues. Of course, EPA, in my experience, is no stranger to working on a wide range of different international issues, whether it's For example, I used to work on the International Cook Stove Project and the challenge of indoor air, or the International Transport of Air Pollutants, or clean international partnerships on clean fuel, or managing hazardous chemicals and the treaties that go along with those, or waste management, international flows of waste management. And a number of these initiatives actually have to do and relate to mining. For example, the Global Mining Initiative that EPA is actively working on has a direct component related to methane control from coal mines. And the Global Mercury Initiative out of UNEP has clear connections with the mining arena. So I think it's within this broader context of EPA's commitment to international work that this workshop is taking place. And I think it further acknowledges what I think all of us know, and that is by working together and sharing and understanding where the perspectives and views of each other, we can come up with better solutions to protecting the environment and human health. So today, I want to, my main purpose today is to kind of provide an overview of the conference for today, and I come to this conversation from the Superfund, from EPA's Superfund program, and we are a program that is dealing with many mine sites, hundreds of mine sites, both in our long-term cleanup program, our emergency response removal programs have addressed a number of mine site issues, abandoned mine site issues over the years. And it's an area that presents substantial challenges to us, imposes tremendous costs on us, and so because of these reasons alone, it's one that we are very interested in, and we're here to learn what we can from you about better and more creative ways of dealing with the challenges of those. We have three themes today, as Bruce mentioned. They fall into categories that I think really capture together many of the issues that we are dealing with. That one theme is innovations in mine site remediation technologies, the issue of sustainability, a growing and dynamic area for all of us, and then the critical issue, and I know you've heard Maddie Stanislaus, my boss, talk about the critical importance of engaging communities and the role that communities play in driving and participating in mine site remediation and reuse. So let me start talking about these three areas. The first one I want to discuss, in no particular order, is the notion of the importance of innovative technology in mine site remediation. As I think about innovation, what comes to mind is the typical mine site. And I'm not sure there is a typical mine site, but some of the physical attributes that define an abandoned mine problem is that they're often large. Companies, because of economies of scale and whatnot, have had to move massive amounts of material either above ground, on the surface, or below ground. So just the sheer physical footprint of mine sites is significant. They cover a large area. They affect multiple media. So we have effects of groundwater. We have complex mine workings, complex interactions with surface water. We have challenging geochemistry and physical challenges. And then mining and the subsequent processing of materials sometimes has involved the use of hazardous chemicals. And so they get thrown into the mix as well. So when I think of these challenges, innovation is something that is just absolutely critical. Because when you're dealing with these massive amounts of material, small changes in improving how we do things and improving our practice can have real economic benefits as we approach mine sites. So the critical importance of thinking innovatively about how we approach mine sites is I think, truly important. And I think a lot of times when we think about innovative technology, we're sort of thinking about, you know, how all the cleanup technologies. But one of the things that we have learned is that one of the areas of innovation has to do with simply how you characterize the problem. And I know one of the things that we have worked on at EPA, and I know our folks are interested in sharing and learning from you about, is are things like site characterization tools and how to better understand sites and innovative visualization techniques that allow us to take these complex environments and make sense of them. So that's one of the things that we're very interested in. Something that all of us have worked on are best management practices. Betsy, Elizabeth, Dr. Sutherland yesterday in her introductory conversations talked about some of the best management practices that are out there internationally, the cyanide standard, for example. One of the things that we did in preparing for this conference was do a survey of many of the international participants. And we know, for example, Argentina, Canada, Hungary, probably others, have developed best management practices for addressing mine sites. Belgium has identified technologies which are commonly used in mine site remediation. So many on the international front are laying down the groundwork for how to approach mine sites and bring innovative technologies to bear. So I know today in some of the presentations of a person from my office, Michelle Mahoney, is going to be talking about some of our successes in applying technologies across the U.S. Our states have been active here in the U.S., and the ITRC is a group that provides technology for us here in the U.S., and we're pleased that Sherry Basinger from Missouri is going to be talking about one of the really important guidance documents that ITRC has developed. And by the way, if you have lead mines in your country, talk to Sherry, because she comes from Missouri, one of the places where lead mining is a critical issue. No doubt she has worked on those kinds of issues. I think another thing about innovation that's important for us all to share is that in the course of finding innovative solutions, we've found things that have worked and we've found things that have not worked. It's very important for all of us to be able to talk equally about what works and what doesn't work. So this is critical. And then finally, a centerpiece of innovation is research. And in the U.S. and I'm sure internationally, there are a number of centers of research for developing innovative technologies. I look at my friend Dave Reisman, who works in our Office of Research and Development. Raise your hand there, Dave. Talk to him if you're interested in research on innovative technologies. He's been a great supporter of our mining, creative approaches to solving mine problems across the U.S. But our Department of Energy has several laboratories that work on this, as well as the Mine Land Reclamation Center in West Virginia. So these all have websites, and if you're interested in the research end of things, talk to Dave and learn more about that. The next issue that I want to spend some time about, and the second major theme of our conference today after innovation, we have a theme and a series of talks on sustainability. And so let me talk a little bit about sustainability when it comes to mine sites. I think one of the things that we need to look towards and to think about when it comes to mines is that they are a resource. They are a tremendous resource. There's a tremendous amount of land. There are materials there that can be used, and the land has value. So let's look at sort of at least three dimensions of this. First, the materials that are on the land. There is a growing effort to try to reuse as many of the mine materials as we possibly can in economically productive ways, whether it's for fill, for road beds, for encapsulated uses, and soil amendments. And so you trying to reuse materials for their physical value is clearly a sustain, kind of a sustainable practice that we all need to think about creative ways of doing. Of course, providing the materials for remining is another growing area, and of course, with the price of commodities varying so much, this is in many cases and in some cases a possibility. And then as an energy source, there mine sites offer a great opportunity to think about siting renewable energy. Let's face it. I mean, the mining operations were on the grid. They had good access to our electrical grid. The land is available, oftentimes open and ready for development. So we have a number of initiatives at EPA. I would point you to our Repowering Land initiative in particular, where we are trying to create some information for people who are interested in repowering, information in terms of looking at the solar, the wind, and the potential for other renewable energy uses of abandoned mine sites. We're also trying to explore the liability issues that are associated with using abandoned mines. One of our great successes, I think, Kent DeBoer is going to be talking about today from Chevron at the Cuesta mine out in New Mexico, where a large array of solar panels have been installed, and that's been mentioned several times this week, and Kent's going to give us a little bit more detail on that. The third and final area of the conference, and one that I know is our attention has been drawn to, particularly with the leadership of our assistant administrator, is engaging communities. And, you know, communities today, they're smart, they're increasingly more sophisticated, they want to understand what is going on, they want transparency, they want to make sure there's accountability in cleanup decisions, and in my program, where community acceptance is a criteria that we have to consider in selecting remedies, working with communities is absolutely critical. I would say as we looked at our survey results, it became clear that working with communities is certainly not something that certainly is an international focus. We took note that in Australia, for example, community consultation forums have been established to act as a liaison between mining sites and the communities. So, and in Serbia, there are programs that have where there's an obligation for employment of the local population. So trying to look at our cleanup programs and how they relate to communities and the role of communities around our sites is a critically important issue for all of us, and one that we will be exploring today. So I hope you find these topics as exciting and interesting as I do. And I know one thing that we have all quickly figured out this week is that one of the facts of life is it may be a different country, but it's the same problem. So I think that's one of the themes behind our conference this week. And so with that, I'd like to wrap up. Please have a productive day. Again, thank you for being here. Thank you for participating and joining in the discussions. And I wish you a wonderful conference and the rest of your stay is safe and fun. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Barnes. Next up, I'd like to introduce Ms. Velma Smith. Velma joined the Pew Environment Group in 2008 She's a member of the government relations team, supporting a range of programs including public lands and mining reform, protection of Arctic resources, and reform of industrial animal agriculture. But prior to coming to PUB, Velma was a senior advisor with the National Environmental Trust, where she worked on issues including water pollution, regulation of mining, and cleanup of hazardous waste. Prior to her work at NET, Velma worked as executive director of Friends of the Earth, land use planner with Loudoun County, Virginia, not far from here, and legislative assistant for Congressman Rick Mosher, handling environmental, energy, and science matters. Velma has been a member of the Environmental Protection Agency's National Drinking Water Advisory Committee, the National Research Council's Committee on Small Water Supply Systems, and the Office of Technology Assessment's Advisory Committee on Agricultural Contamination of Groundwater. She also served on the Virginia State Water Control Board. Velma has a master's degree in urban and regional planning from the University of Virginia and a BA in journalism from the University of Georgia. And today she'll be speaking about the Pew campaign for responsible mining and other related matters here. But please join me in welcoming Velma Smith.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, I think. Honestly, I just wanted to start with a little disclosure. As you can tell from my bio, I'm not a civil engineer. I'm not a mining geologist. I haven't worked at a mine. I haven't worked at a mine reclamation site. So I'm feeling a little healthy dose of trepidation right now. My perspectives come from a different experience, from years of working with individuals impacted by mining activities, or in some cases, the folks that are wary of proposed mining activities, from working with communities whose water supplies have been degraded by mine operations, listening to regulators and technical experts, plowing through documentation about mine rot problems, and on occasion, visiting a mine or a mine reclamation site. So it's from that perspective that I think about these things, and I'm going to ask you to start the day away from the details and think not just about the most promising advances for addressing that good old problem of acid mine drainage, you know, new prediction tools, the best options for regrading or revegetating, or frankly any particular innovations in site remediation viewed narrowly. Rather, I'm going to ask you to think broadly about the challenges of mining reclamation in the 21st century. Sorry. And think about the challenges that I believe will grow more difficult despite all of yours and our best efforts. You know that better than I. Mining has in many ways grown more sophisticated, as Bruce referenced, more careful of the environment compared with certain historic practices. But mining's footprint, in other ways, has grown larger, more complicated, and in some respects, much heavier. If you recall, as I can, for those of you in this country, the old Bonanza and Gunsmoke TV episodes, you think of the miners of the Wild West who used picks and axes and harvested nuggets that you could put in your pocket. Not so much today, when gold mining focuses on microscopic particles. In this country, many operators are now going after deposits that would never have been of interest before. And that means, as we've said, a lot of waste. It means pouring chemicals on heaps of pulverized ore, blasting off the tops of mountains, inducing subsidence to dig deeper. Now, I'm not here today to say don't look at those techniques, though, of course, others would make those arguments. I'm here to say that those techniques can have serious and lasting consequences. Huge volumes of waste to be managed, water to be diverted, held, or restored, landscapes that will be dramatically changed forever. These technologies make dramatic changes to the environment and present enormous challenges for effective regulations. Challenges that I believe must be acknowledged to be met. They require far more than cosmetic cleanup. They require an increasingly advanced level of reclamation. Another challenge here is that mining is closer to people, or better said, people have moved closer to mines and to once mined lands. Though common wisdom says that U.S. mining and mineral processing takes place in remote areas where people are largely unaffected, the census tells us a different story. A 1997 EPA study found over 1 million children living within 5 miles of 300-plus hard rock and phosphate mines. That was then less than a third of the estimated total U.S. hard rock mines. With pollutants like lead, arsenic, cyanide, mercury, you know the list, the convergence of people and mining, past and present, can mean big problems. Lead-contaminated backyards, subsidence under highways and playgrounds, youngsters driving off-road vehicles through clouds of arsenic dust. I could go on, and I could have offered pictures, but you know that the list is long, and you know that the pictures are ugly. Another challenge. As our population has grown, particularly in the West here, where much mining takes place, the pressure on remaining landscapes increases. That means that wild, untouched places are fewer and all the more dear today. But mining regulations and reclamation programs frequently disregard or discount these important public uses of land. They shouldn't. So for those of you who may take away lessons from mine reclamation policy elsewhere, and to those of you who have some capacity to improve the policies here, I'd offer a few thoughts. I believe we can learn from what we've done right in the U.S. and what we've failed to do. And on that point, I'd say there's no better starting point than 1977, when the nation faced up to the fact that coal mining was not adequately regulated and that coal mining had left too many scars. Passage of federal law, or the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, or SMCRA, said not only we must do better going forward, but also we must deal with and pay for past mistakes. I know there can be arguments about whether that law's implementation has been too lax or too tough, but no one can argue that the abandoned mine land program funded by a modest fee on coal production has not been of enormous value here. Some of the statistics, thousands of mine openings closed, safeguards for people, property, the environment, program expenditures over a 25-year period estimated to have returned $4 billion to the economy and created over 150,000 jobs. Unfortunately, the universe of abandoned coal mines and coal mining damage in the U.S. was not fully known and is still coming to light, so the work continues, as it should. But the bigger and far more important mistake we made in 1977 was to focus solely on coal. And that is why today we're engaged in a protracted argument about improving regulation of mining for gold, silver, copper, uranium, and other minerals. A story perhaps for another day. It's also why the Department of Interior's Inspector General has issued harsh warnings about public safety on public lands, on some public lands, and financially strapped states press the federal government to use coal monies for cleanup of other types of mines. Coal monies can't be stretched to cover cleanup of all abandoned mine problems, and coal producers should not be asked to pay the freight for all mine cleanups. All mine sectors that have created mine problems should be pressed to help. Other lessons learned, at least partially, come from the mid-century U.S. uranium mining. On that score, policymakers learned that uranium tailings, once given away and used to build roads and houses, must be managed as waste, not building material. Federal law requires that uranium tailings depositories now be deeded over to the federal government or managed by the states in perpetuity. Yet we've yet to have a great deal of experience in that effort since the uranium industry went into an economic tailspin about the time that the law was passed. and few modern tailings facilities have been constructed. Still, the precedent of looking into the future to establish responsibility for long-term management is there. To make the business of reclamation manageable for the next generation, we should begin now to apply that precedent to other types of mining. Not all mine sites are going to merit this ultra-long-term care, but some will clearly, as you know, require many years of monitoring and active care, pumping groundwater, treating water, filling open pits. A study by the EPA Office of Inspector General a few years back noted that nearly 60% of the mining and mineral processing sites on our Superfund list are expected to require from 40 years to perpetuity for cleanup. Another study by the National Academy of Sciences underscores those problems and notes inadequate consideration of protection of the land from future land uses, the need for perpetual site maintenance and protection from inevitable but rare but inevitable natural emergencies. So I would say it's time for mining and reclamation plans to be forward-looking, hard-nosed in considering contingencies, clear on assigning responsibilities, and specific about financial obligations of mine operators. On the issue of financial obligations, the U.S., again, has important precedents with bonding requirements in SMACRA and state law and for mining on public lands. Unfortunately, however, bond amounts have frequently been short of cleanup needs. EPA has determined that non-coal mining is the sector with the largest financial drain on our National Superfund program, and the Government Accountability Office has warned of serious shortfalls in bonding amounts for hard rock mines on public lands. There are no doubt a range of reasons for this. Inspector General report noted, sometimes inflation isn't considered. Often acid mine drainage is inaccurately predicted. When cleanup is delayed, bond amounts are not updated. Again, this bears some repetition. The National Academy of Sciences has pointed to serious deficiencies in the prediction of water quality impacts associated with mines. The problem was confirmed by a peer-reviewed retrospective study of environmental impact statements prepared in this country. When it came to water quality, mining plans and mining mitigation plans simply did not perform as advertised. What that says to me, folks, is that it's time for those preparing mine plans and mine reclamation plans to take off those rose-colored glasses, infuse this business with some technological humility, and a good dose of honesty about the uncertainties. Mining and mine reclamation is tough stuff, clearly, and getting tougher. Whether you're mining or cleaning up a mine, things won't always go as planned. So be ready with Plan B and be alert for the signs of problems. Don't reassure when you should really react. Just a few other things before I close. You know that mines tend to be long-lived, sometimes prolific in production, and sometimes lingering on in the mining equivalent, I would say, of life support, existing for many years on standby before they truly close and begin reclamation in earnest or begin working to avoid it. And many mines begin with one footprint on paper and over the years cover a much larger footprint as mining expands. Just ask the residents of Salt Lake, Utah, or Butte, Montana. Sometimes delays are difficult to avoid. Sometimes expansions are a good thing. But those of you planning mines or overseeing mine reclamation may also need to consider what I would call an unwritten social contract with the communities that you work in. Mine reclamation plans, drafted and vetted long before mining begins, should commit to restoration that fits the needs of the communities and the needs of those who enjoy the landscapes that are affected. So when a community or a community of interest insists on those plans being followed, even if it means leaving some metals in the ground or pressing for a date certain on closure, that contract should be honored. All of us also understand that ores that are treated as waste at one metal price can become valuable at another price or to another company with a different financial portfolio, and that some ores contain multiple minerals. For example, here, uranium in the southwestern copper mines. Some of us also realize that the grades of some ores being mined in this country today pale in comparison to the mineral content of the electronic trash we throw away. With those facts, what those facts suggest to me is that mining subsidies that promote digging new mines in greenfields, something this country has plenty of, subsidies, not so much the greenfields, would be better targeted to clean up and to responsible recovery of minerals from existing waste ores as well as from other waste streams. Finally, a word to those of you who may be a little frustrated that I kept weaving mining policy into a discussion of mine reclamation. You may say that I did not stay on topic. I insist that I did. The two topics in my mind are fully intertwined. Good mining policies will help to diminish the burdens of mine reclamation. And reclamation that works does not begin when the digging stops. The seeds of successful reclamation are sown before a mine site is selected and before mining begins. I thank you for your attention and your hard work in the field of reclamation, and I look forward to your questions. Thanks so much.
We'll be
Thanks very much, Thelma.
Q&A session.
Next up is Mr. Kelly Payne.
You can submit your questions at any moment.
Kelly is the environmental manager at Kennecott Utah Copper. Interesting convergence of themes here. A fully owned subsidiary of Rio Tinto and is based in Salt Lake City, Utah. He's a hydrologist with 15 years of experience in the mining industry, including the last 7 years with Kennecott. Holds a B.S. and an M.S. In geology and is a member of the Utah Board of Oil, Gas, and Mining. This morning, Kelly will be speaking with us about Global Miners' perspective on mine site remediation and reuse. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Kelly Payne.
Kelly's slides begin on slide 7. And once again, you can ask questions using the question mark button at the top of the screen.
Thanks, Bruce.
Anytime.
Thanks, Thelma. I appreciate the passion that you bring to this discussion. Good morning. It's an honor to be invited to offer a mining industry perspective on the topic of mine lands use and remediation. This is a topic that is important to industry, as many companies, Rio Tinto not excepted, have as their legacy mining impacted lands. Sustainably remediating and rehabilitating land and water affected by mining and prevention of new contaminated mine sites is important, not only to manage financial and technical risks, but also secure and retain our social license to operate. Let me first introduce you to Rio Tinto. We are one of the world's leading mining companies, employing over 77,000 people, and we provide vital metals and minerals to the world economy. Wherever we operate, safety is our key priority, and sustainable development is at the heart of our business. For Rio Tinto, underlying earnings in 2010 were a record $14 billion, and in the first half of 2011, underlying earnings were $7.8 billion. We have a diverse portfolio of products with a primary focus on iron ore, aluminum, copper, and coal. We primarily operate in Australia and North America, but have mining sites in over 40 countries. Slide number 10. Next slide, okay. On six continents. In the United States, our operations include the Kennecott, Utah Copper, Bingham Canyon Mine, and the U.S. Borax operations in Southern California. Rio Tinto principally targets large, long-lived, low-cost ore bodies. Next. Rio Tinto is a founding member of the International Council on Mining and Metals, or ICMM. which is a CEO-led organization dedicated to raising standards across the industry as a whole and distinguishing its members as leaders in the industry. ICMM members meet 3 times a year to discuss pressing sustainable development challenges faced by our industry, and we report publicly against our sustainable development performance on an annual basis. It is through ICMM that we've received the invitation to provide these remarks today. Next, ICMM member companies include 21 of the industry leaders, not only in production and revenue, but also social and environmental performance. These companies are listed on this slide, and just yesterday I'll note that ICMM welcomed Codelco from Chile as a new member. Next. ICMM member companies operate over 800 mining sites in 62 countries around the world. Next. One of the fundamental commitments that ICMM member companies make is to sustainable development, or SD, as shown on this slide. Underpinning that commitment is a set of 10 principles, coupled with public reporting of our performance and external assurance programs. Next. The 10 principles include these shown here. I won't read them all, but a particularly relevant to today's topic is Principle 4, which addresses risk management, including environment and human health risk associated with contaminated land, and Principles 5 and 6, which describe or require continual improvement in environmental performance. ICMM member companies collectively and individually have also adopted a set of 6 position statements listed on the right there, addressing a range of social and environmental issues facing the industry. Next.
Slide 16.
With that background, let me present our 5-point approach to mine land remediation and reuse. First, remediation practitioners understand that the first step in any cleanup project is source control. So you recognize my first point here, which is to have policies, performance standards, and management systems to robustly prevent creating new remediation liabilities. This is not to say that we operate to supply the world's needs for metals and minerals without impacting land. Indeed, by its very nature, mining must disturb the land. What we do recognize is that disturbance should and must remain within designed and approved boundaries. Discharges to land, air, and water must remain in compliance with regulatory constraints, and materials which have the potential to cause contamination must be controlled and monitored. Second, we believe in implementing remedies that are robust and sustainable. What this means is that at times we choose strategies that cost more and have greater complexity because the end result leaves us with a solution that eliminates the need for long-term monitoring and maintenance, keeps us from having to come back and do it over again, and is consistent with our commitment to leaving a positive legacy in the communities where we operate. Third, we accept financial and management responsibility for mine land remediation, for which we are or may be a responsible party. We found that it makes good business sense to be transparent and cooperative with reasonable regulatory agencies and programs. Fourth, we invest in technology and development and do not shy away from innovation. Just as we do with mining processes, we know that we can find ways to get remediation projects done faster, smarter, better, and cheaper. Last, but of no less importance, we recognize the important role of communities in remediation programs and actively seek to engage and consult those impacted by contaminated land and water and are impacted by our cleanup programs. Next slide. What I'd like to do now is discuss how this approach that I've just outlined has grown out of and been successfully applied to Rio Tinto's experience at Kennecott, Utah Copper. Shown here is a historical photograph of the first of 3 smelters to operate at the Kennecott site. Copper mining and processing began at Kennecott in the year 1906, in a mining district that had been mined for lead, silver, and other base metals since the 1860s. The environmental legacy at the site is one characterized by early disposal of lead mine waste rock and lead mill tailings in and adjacent to mountain creeks, poorly controlled leach water management, smelter emissions containing sulfur, lead, selenium, and arsenic, which emissions were severe enough that the early operator of the smelter had to secure smoke easements from neighboring landowners. Also impacting land and water were disposal of weak acid blowdown treatment sludge and unlined wetlands ponds and fugitive emissions to groundwater of selenium and arsenic-bearing electrolytic refining process solutions. You won't find a denier here that mining has a checkered past. Next. The Kennecott operation is located in the western United States in the state of Utah near Salt Lake City. To put this into community's perspective and give a sense of scale, this recent aerial image shows the Salt Lake City metropolitan area. With the Bingham Canyon mine located here on the south, the city is located along a corridor around the interstate, and then 14 miles north of the mine, we have a smelter, a refinery, a power plant, and a 9,000-acre tailings impoundment. You'll also note on this slide the proximity of our operations to the Great Salt Lake, which has migratory bird habitat of hemispheric importance. And then it may be difficult to see here, but I'll point out the, as was alluded to in Velma's talk, the advancing residential development in the southwest portion of the valley that is putting neighbors closer and closer to us every year. From our perspective, this is one of the few mine sites in the world, few large mine sites in the world that operate in such close proximity to a major metropolitan area. Next slide.
19.
The land and water were contaminated by mining activities at the site began to get meaningful regulatory and community attention in the mid-80s, although it was certainly known but not fully appreciated decades earlier. Cleanup began in earnest in the early 1990s. The magnitude of the figures listed on the screen should leave an impression on anyone familiar with mining or remediation and give a sense of the immensity of the task that Rio Tinto faced and certainly didn't value or comprehend when it acquired the Kennecott operation in 1989. The work behind these figures has been conducted by Kennecott under oversight of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency using authority granted by the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, or CERCLA, as well as the state of Utah under state statute. And I'll speak to these points further in a moment. What is also important to point out is that this work has been conducted while continuing to profitably operate the mine and processing facilities. Next slide. These next few slides show some before and after photographs of several areas of mine land remediation. These images show Bingham Creek, directly below the mine. Lead tailings disposed on the banks of the creeks by early miners washed nearly 11 miles downstream and were also spread through irrigation ditches onto farmland that was later converted to residential housing. The first official cleanup at the Kennecott site was an emergency removal by action by EPA in these residential areas. Later, Kennecott itself took over cleanup operations and conducted a removal in the Bingham Creek Channel. Early on in our cleanup process, we made a decision that when performing soil cleanups, we would look wider and dig deeper to assure that all soil that we could detect that exceeded an unrestricted or residential land use standard was removed. In the case of contamination that occurred outside the Kennecott fence line, we felt that, although traditional, this was the most robust and sustainable approach that we could undertake. Next. In Butterfield Creek, south of the mine, lead waste had been stacked on the banks of the creek by early operators. Now the owner of the contaminated land, we conducted a complete removal of these wastes to prevent further impacts to the environment and downstream agricultural water users. Next. In 1965, a predecessor constructed a reservoir in Bingham Creek to manage barren copper leach water. Operated through 1991, this reservoir leaked low pH water with high dissolved solids and elevated metals into the subsurface. In the early 1990s, Kennecott removed tens of feet of sediment accumulated in the reservoir, installed a state-of-the-art triple-lined system with leak detection and leak collection, which continues to function robustly today. However, Kennecott will be cleaning up the acidic and neutral groundwater contamination covering more than 10 square miles for decades to come. Next slide. The millions of cubic yards of contaminated soil that were moved on at the Kennecott site needed a home. We've constructed a number of soil repositories on site, including the one shown here. what we've attempted to do in constructing these soil repositories is to locate them, co-locate them with other mineral wastes so that we minimize our footprint. And we've used state-of-the-art liner technology and gone over and above what may have been required by CERCLA in constructing these repositories. One of the other important things that we've accomplished is the demolition of and the retirement of old facilities that were the source of some of this contamination. On the left here, you can see the second of three smelters that were on site that was retired in the mid-1990s. Today's smelter is among the cleanest in the world and captures 99.9% or more of the sulfur that is generated in the smelting process.
You're on slide 24.
Despite our best efforts to identify and clean up contaminated land, there continue to be surprises. I remember distinctly the morning we took a call from a local developer informing us that during due diligent work on a parcel that he was poised to start work on, he'd come across an old tailwater ditch last used 70 years previous, which contained elevated levels of arsenic. This ditch, 17 miles in total length, was buried under farm fields, school fields, and subdivisions. The image on the right shows the alignment of the ditch, part of the ditch through a residential area. Recognizing that despite being buried under 2 to 4 feet of soil, which coupled with land use restrictions would be an acceptable remedy under CERCLA, we made a commitment to remove the contaminated ditch sediments from accessible parcels and remove for us the need for ongoing monitoring and control and land use restrictions. We also sampled over 70 residential yards as well as school fields in areas where the ditch had been disturbed during home construction and found only a few areas of surface contamination which we have removed. What we do where the ditch remains in place between homes and in school fields is still being evaluated. Next slide. Let me tell you next about innovative reuse of mining land in our portfolio. From 1936 through 1965, and occasionally through the 1980s, predecessors utilized what were termed evaporation ponds for disposal of barren leach water and storm water from the mine area. In addition to creating a separate area of groundwater contamination, sediment precipitated from this water contained high levels of arsenic. In the mid-1990s, we consolidated and capped these sediments on site. Later in the mid-2000s, we returned to the site and undertook a complete removal in order to facilitate a residential development that we call Daybreak. Daybreak is Kennecott's first community development program, comprising over 4,000 acres of both mining-affected and unaffected land. When it is finally built out over the next 10 to 15 years, it will include almost 14,000 homes, 30% open space, as well as job centers, shopping, and entertainment. The Daybreak development is an example of how we've committed to sustainable development, of how the commitment to sustainable development that we've adopted in our mining operations can be applied to non-traditional aspects of our business. Homes within the Daybreak development are ENERGY STAR certified. All secondary irrigation, all stormwater is retained on site, and we are partnering with developers to put homes, to have homes built with energy or with solar and geothermal aspects already installed in the home. Let me speak next to the second of my points. Third of my points, which is transparency and cooperation. The regulatory history at the Kennecott site is nearly as complicated as the operational history. There is an understandable tendency for a mining company to put up its defenses when threatened with intervention into its business by a regulatory program, especially one that carries as big a stick as CERCLA. In the early days of Kennecott's interaction with EPA on land remediation, the company's posture wasn't exactly one of the transparency and cooperation that we espouse today, but we got there. It's pretty amazing how the threat of listing on the Superfund National Priorities List can motivate a company to come to the table. EPA formally proposed to list the Kennecott South Zone and Kennecott North Zone on the National Priorities List in early 1994. After initial negotiations over the scope and financial responsibility for the cleanup broke down. A year and a half later, after changes in personnel on both sides, Kennecott, EPA, and the state of Utah agreed to a landmark agreement documenting what we affectionately refer to as the MOU, or Memorandum of Understanding. This 1.5-page document says simply that Kennecott agrees to perform the cleanup and that EPA agrees to defer finalizing listing on the NPL, and when work is completed, withdraw the listing proposals. That document remains a cornerstone of how we operate at the site today and was the first of EPA's ventures in what would be come to be called the Superfund Alternative Site Process. EPA highlighted the success of this approach in a 2006 case study. The benefits of the transparent and cooperative approach have been lower overall cleanup costs and earned regulatory and community trust. Early estimates by Kennecott suggested that had we not adopted this approach, total cleanup costs would have been about a third higher. Look at that against the $1.5 billion that we have spent on cleanup to date, and you can quickly see the business case for this approach. From a personal perspective, since I inherited responsibility for the cleanup programs in 2004, I value the tone set by those who negotiated the MOU just 9 years earlier. The job is more satisfying when it is not premised on daily wrangling with the regulatory agencies and when on-the-ground progress is readily apparent. A direct benefit of the MOU was the deproposal of the Kennecott South Zone in 2008, following the entry of a consent decree and posting of financial assurance. We expect deproposal of the North Zone to follow soon. Next.
Slide 29.
While we have mostly approached land remediation with traditional strategies, we have invested in technology related to groundwater remediation and treatment. Shown is a water treatment plant for circumneutral groundwater that produces high-quality drinking water for distribution to local communities whose groundwater resource development opportunities have been constrained by mining contamination. This plant uses familiar reverse osmosis technology that has been adapted through extensive pilot testing to treat neutral mine-impacted water. We've also experimented extensively at parts of the site with in-situ and ex-situ technologies for the treatment of selenium-contaminated water. And we successfully used acidic reservoir sediments blended with carbonaceous local soils to create growth media for reclamation of mineway dumps. Next. Community engagement consultation is an integral part of remediation and reuse strategy, especially when contamination has migrated outside the fence line, but also when it's contained on site. We strive to be honest, transparent, and forthright in the community and stakeholders about the risks not only to human health, but also to ecological receptors. We've taken numerous approaches to the community involvement, including those listed here, public meetings and open houses, technical review committees, which are comprised of local governments, the local water district, and regulators and NGO groups that meets on a, now it meets on about an annual basis, but early on we were meeting monthly. As we evaluated alternatives and presented these alternatives to the technical review committee for input and evaluation. One of the pitfalls of our technical review committee is it tended to be mostly technical folks, and there was often a not good communication between the technical review committee and the communities or the interests that they represented. In about 2004, seeing this disconnect, the State of Utah Department of Environmental Quality initiated a stakeholder forum which brought together broader interests, evening meetings rather than daytime meetings, and presented in a more public way what the cleanup at Kennecott means and the options and challenges that we have ahead of us. And although it's not listed here, I cannot say enough about personal relationships. I can't tell you how many people have my phone number as well. What I found helpful when we were working on the ditch that I mentioned earlier is that rather than the community relations team going out and talking to people in the community, that I went door to door myself and was able to speak with everybody who was impacted by that ditch. And they knew who they could call if they had questions, and had a greater understanding of what was going on. So at the top of our 5-point strategy that I presented earlier, I mentioned, I highlighted the prevention of creation of new mining liabilities, and I'd like to come back to that now. At that time, I likened it to source control. I'd like to spend a few moments discussing how Rio Tinto has taken to heart the lessons learned at Kennecott and elsewhere to manage our environmental risks in a common approach so that we avoid creating new liabilities, not only in jurisdictions where we're certain to be held to account for our actions, but in every jurisdiction around the world, regardless of the robustness of local environmental regulation. The notion of pollution prevention is highlighted in our Global Code of Business Conduct titled The Way We Work. And the statement there is quoted on the screen, wherever possible we prevent or else minimize, reduce, and remedy of the disturbance of the environment. Next. Supporting this principle is a policy and a set of environmental performance standards. Each managed business unit in Rio Tinto must abide by these standards as well as local regulations. Even in the United States, with its many environmental statutes, we find the Rio Tinto performance standards to be more stringent in some aspects than local regulation. Let me highlight a few of the clauses from these performance standards that contribute to the prevention of new remediation liabilities. However, let me first note that although the title page shown here is marked confidential, these performance standards are readily accessible on Rio Tinto's external website. The fourth standard that's listed here is called Hazardous Materials and Contamination Control. What this standard covers is the management of bulk materials to prevent spillage and environmental contamination. And some of the things that we're required to do under this standard is to identify and assess the environmental contamination risks, implement spill prevention controls, and develop internal criteria for assessment of site contamination when government regulations are absent or incomplete. We're required to maintain effective containment barriers. And one of the things that sites both in the U.S. and worldwide struggle with is the notion that the storage tanks and pipelines containing or transporting hazardous materials must be above ground. It's more stringent than any regulation we have in the U.S. Any exceptions to this policy have to be justified and authorized by a managing director, and such exceptions must be based on risk assessment and provision of additional pollution controls. The standard also requires that we develop, document, and implement a remediation strategy for those existing sites, contaminated sites where site investigation shown there is an unacceptable environmental impact to current land uses. So what this does is take a standard that we already are familiar with here in the U.S. and apply it on a global scale. Non-mineral waste is the sixth on the list there. One of the requirements of that standard is that disposal of waste must be carried out only in engineered and approved facilities. So no waste dumps out the back door. We have a mineral waste standard that requires that for each waste disposal facility or site, we maintain an up-to-date conceptual and or numeric model of the long-term physical and chemical waste behavior and impacts on the environment, and that we establish and maintain a documented mineral waste management plan that covers all stages of waste management from generation to final use and or disposal. We have a standard that addresses acid rock drainage, the second on the list. Requires that we develop and implement an acid rock drainage management plan, and that we maintain a monitoring procedure appropriate to the potential impacts, which at a minimum allows adequate early warning of unacceptable impacts, facilitates management decisions, and supports the ongoing prediction programs and confirms the assumptions used in the plan. We're also required to arrange for independent reviews of ARD management intervals on about an every 3-year basis. Finally, I'll mention air quality. One notion in the standard is that we're required to develop internal criteria on ambient air quality when government regulations are absent or incomplete to ensure protection of the local environment, local community health, and the environment. These performance standards are coupled with a number of other standards I'll just briefly mention, including a closure standard. This is a multidisciplinary standard, so we don't lump this with the environmental standards because we're required not only to consider the physical aspects of closure, how we reshape and reclaim the land, but also how we mitigate impacts to communities. we have along with that, and very much in parallel, the ICMM has published a closure toolkit that addresses promotes an integrated closure planning approach.
Slide 34.
We also have a communities policy and standard that addresses, lays out how we work with our communities, including the areas of remediation and closure planning. One of the things that the communities folks highlight to me is that as they're working on a global scale, that even in developed countries, that capacity building is often a challenge when dealing with remediation. As we go to work with groups, often they don't understand what the issues are. They're not familiar with mining. For instance, I've just returned from an exploration site in Peru, and one of the issues there is water quality. And what the local site there has done is done a lot of capacity building with a nominated group of local residents to educate them about what water quality is, how to measure pH, how to understand metals results. But the investment capacity building is important on a global scale. Last time I'll mention our biodiversity strategy, which states that our goal is to have a net positive impact on biodiversity. I'd like to say we've got this one completely figured out. We're working on it, and we're working on how we integrate that into remediation. We realize that we have opportunities when we're undertaking land remediation as we put things back together to promote biodiversity, whether that's in the selection of particular plant species, or if we're in a wetlands environment, how we encourage the use of birds or other species of that type. So I'll end with that. The information about Rio Tinto, Kennecott, or ICMM is found on the web at these addresses. Thank you.
I'd like to remind you that you can submit your questions to the moderator by hitting the question mark icon at the top of the screen.
Very good. Thank you, Kelly, and Velma and Barnes as well. And I think now we have a few minutes for questions, and I'm going to be looking to our technology folks to see whether we have a queue forming online as well, or please jump in. But Winnie. And thank you again for using the microphone.
Please remember
to introduce yourself as well.
To indicate the question is for.
Thinking broadly about mining issues will increasingly involve critical questioning about sustainability and responsibility. I'm pretty sure about that. It may even involve social protests in the near future. You mentioned that deposits never been mined before are now of special interest, and this holds especially true in gold mining, which has reached, in my opinion, an absurd stage where it totally disconnects from strategic industrial needs today. It serves as an investor safe haven and brings joy and social status to people in emerging countries, which more than others hang it most enthusiastically around their necks. So, most seriously, we have to ask ourselves, what are the real social and economic benefits arising from this kind of mining? And weigh it against the ecological damage it leaves behind. And more so, how it befires doomsday scenarios in the context of our shaky world economy. You know? So, what would be a way to curb it down? I think a special taxation on excessive gold mining would curb down this gung-ho attitude we see nowadays in this kind of mining.
Well, I agree you make an important point, and there are mines and there are mines, and, you know, not to pick on gold, I'm wearing a gold wedding band, but, you know, there's the point at which we go crazy in terms of going into areas and mining and, you know, fueling, you know, people's, you know, get rich quick sort of schemes. And I think, you know, one of the things is, like, for example, in this country, there are no royalties on gold that's taken from public lands, basically, even though it's a the mineral itself, the land belongs to the American public, there are no royalties. You could impose royalties on minerals, and you could impose royalties that vary depending upon the need for the mineral and the considerations of, you know, strategic importance. I think at some level, trying to look at, I think the issue of strategic minerals always gets used to say mine more, but sometimes looking at managing strategic minerals might say be judicious in what you mine and what you use and how you reuse. So it's, I mean, you've hit on a really tough issue, which I don't have an answer to.
Hello, my question is for Kelly Payne. Thank you very much, Kelly, for that wonderful slide presentation. What you've done at Rio Tinto is impressive from the slides presented. But I was piqued, my curiosity was piqued when you referenced a reasonable regulatory agency, and I'd like to know what is your definition of reasonable. What are instances of your interactions with an unreasonable regulatory agency, and what are your, if you could please give an instance of a reasonable regulatory agency. You indicated personality changes. Well, if the philosophy of a regulator is the mission of the regulator is driven by personalities, there should not be a change in outcome due to personality differences. So I would like to know, you know, what's reasonable, what's not reasonable in your experience of working with different regulators.
You know, I once wrote an EIS for the Forest Service, or worked on an EIS for the Forest Service as a contractor, and I had very much the same question: what do I need to bring to you? You know, what level of effort do you need? And they just said, "Well, we'll know it when we see it." So, you know, and I don't want to dodge the question, because in my experience at Kennecott, we've not been faced with what I would term as unreasonable regulators. But I know that there are jurisdictions in the country where I think we would say that the regulation, mining regulation, maybe has gone too far, and it's gone too far with the express or maybe the unexpressed intent of just stopping mining altogether. And we don't think that the application of regulation is where we should be having a policy discussion over whether or not we should be mining.
Good morning. My name is Frida White from the Navajo Nation. With respect to information that you provided where you're exceeding the CERCLA construction requirements of soil, a soil repository, would you comment on what you mean by that and how much more it costs with respect to that, and describe minimally what CERCLA construction requires? Thank you.
So the repository that I showed on the screen was a soil repository that had a triple line system, where CERCLA would likely have only required that we had a single line system, but we rebuilt it to RCRA Subtitle C standards, although that wasn't required. The cost for that, it was quite a bit an increased cost. It was before my time. I don't have those figures, but if you want to get a card from me afterwards, I can get those numbers and get those to you.
I want to do the right technology thing here, but do we have other comments from the internet?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Question from Lizzie Moss of the British Columbia Ministry of Environment in Canada. Question is, are Rio Tinto standards documents publicly available?
Yes,
they are. They're, as I noted, although they're stamped confidential, they're readily available on our website, riotinto.com.
A reminder, you may submit questions to the moderator at any time using the question mark icon at the top of the screen. A text box will pop up and allow you to submit your questions.
Doing his own mining there of the email. Maybe I'll ask as well. First question for Kelly. Do you have a sense of the variability among industry groups that are participating in the ICMM? I understand there's a framework. Industries have come together and made and agreed to this common mission. I'm wondering how you might characterize the, since we have officials from governments across the world here today, I wonder what they would see if they were to come back and talk with their mining companies as well. Are you all about at the same level in terms of implementation of the framework, I guess would be the question.
So the ICMM has a program where when new members come in, there's a period, I believe it's 2 years, during which they need to come up to complete compliance with the commitments that are laid out, not just sustainable development, but there's commitments around mercury, around artisanal mining, social HIV/AIDS. There's a number of commitments that are non-environmental, and they need to come up to speed with those in 2 years. But it would be my thought, and I'm not an expert on ICMM, that if you talk to any member company, they should have a similar level of commitment to those policies and as, you know, at least the minimum implementation, if not more, across the board.
Is that level of, is the framework in some way based on what you see to be an average? I know, you know, the people in the room from other countries would probably laugh, but I'm trying to get a sense of how the framework was developed. Do you look at the different regulatory frameworks for within those countries that have large-scale mining interests, and then were your principles defined to achieve maximum or average regulatory framework standards, perhaps, or would you say they're more down there at the?
So the ICMM promotes a set of principles. This is how we want to operate. This is how we're going to do business without making any prescriptive standards. That's up to the companies themselves to adopt those standards. But it says here's the minimum expectations that we have when you are setting standards around communities and around environmental performance.
Very good. Thank you very much. Other comments on the line? Thelma, I guess I have a question for you as well here. Yes? Oh, great.
Bashful Dave, as she said. From the, all three panelists in 25 words or less, my question is, with the, is this politically acceptable, demise of Superfund, how do you all see this nation cleaning up all our orphan and legacy mines that there are no PRPs?
You want a tweet, is that what you want?
I didn't say that.
You know, my perspective is from the industry where we take responsibility, and certainly we look around as we go in. I'm going to use more than 25 words. As we go around the country in exploration exercises where we're constantly in areas that have a past mining history that do need attention, you know, where lead wastes are running off and running into creeks. How we're going to address that, you know, I think we've heard from Velma about the tax under SMACRA on coal mine operators. You know, whether I think the debate needs to be had as to whether that applies to hard rock.
I would offer that while I can see your implication and concede that the demise of the EPA Super Fund is probably true, because we haven't been collecting Superfund taxes anymore, and we're not getting, you know, appropriations, that the Superfund liability that still exists makes people do things that they might not have otherwise done. They look at what their future liabilities might be and, you know, in that case, choose to do more. So I think you will get some cleanup in that way, and I think the other will be, you know, chasing them down and getting them and getting them on enforcement. Sure.
If I could just add one thing, Good Samaritan reform, I think, would be a big step as well.
Okay. Thanks, Dave, for the question. I guess I need to start off with challenging the premise that somehow Superfund is dead. I mean, our taxing authority, our fee system, was not reenacted back in the 90s, but we've had a solid pattern of regular annual appropriations to help support our Superfund activities. I think what Dave is alluding to is the challenge before us in terms of cleanup is as big as it has ever been, and we have to be very judicious and thoughtful about how we spend and use the money that we have available to us. As some have mentioned, I think maybe Velma mentioned the GAO report that was done several years ago. We have hundreds of thousands of abandoned mines in the United States, and they pose physical hazards that, of course, the Superfund law doesn't directly deal with, but then they have contamination issues as well. And one of the approaches that this administration has proposed, not by EPA, but by our friends at the Department of Interior, is a set of fees and royalties that could be directed towards dealing with the abandoned mine problem. I think we all recognize this is a huge, huge issue, and not just in the U.S., but in countries around the world. It's very difficult to impose. It's a huge challenge, and so this is one approach that has been thought through and has been advanced. We'll see if it gets legs or not. But I think the challenge of abandoned mines is a large one, and one that does need additional funding to be addressed.
This is Jim Gusick. I'm a mining engineer, and this keys right off of what your last comment is. But I think that what really might be worth looking at is, rather than a tax on the mining industry, might be a tax on the luxury gold jewelry or silver. When you buy a gold ring, you pay a surcharge for that ring that goes into a fund for abandoned mine lands, or if there's a tax on electronics that contains metals that would have, I think the public would be more willing to pay that tax knowing what it would, that it'd be going towards abandoned mines. Because right now I pay my utility bill, and I know that a piece of that utility bill is tax on the coal that's used to make my electricity. I'm willing to pay that because I know that it's going to the, you know, abandoned mine land program for coal reclamation. So you might want to look at it from a different perspective as where those funds might come from.
I do agree that there are a variety of models we can look at for potential fundraising. I mean, some states we pay a tax. You pay a fee when you get rid of your tires so that they can be disposed of properly. There can be ways to spread the pain in a variety of means, and I think everybody should come to the table with something to offer on this.
to try to do this. And I do, I would return again to ways that right now we subsidize. We have tax subsidies, percentage depletion allowance, expensing charges under taxing that subsidize virgin, you know, greenfield mining. We do that by not charging a royalty. We can change, if we would alter those kind of subsidies and get, you know, then go ahead and subsidize the cleanup of the waste stores, the mining of the waste stores, as opposed to the mining of the greenfields.
Yeah, I'm Ron Nimmelman from Nova Gold. A lot of people have mentioned the water question here, and it's a specific technical question. I think one of the things we struggle with, both in new mines and remediation here in this country, is criterion standards. And a lot of the criterion standards that we deal with were based on research that was 30, 40 years ago, that EPA did very good work at a national level. But in a lot of cases, are frankly out of date and not very applicable to a lot of the streams and places we see in the mining industry. And I think we spend a lot of time and money treating standards that really are, trying to treat the standards that are antiquated, and it's not very efficient. And I guess the question I'd have for EPA is, you know, we've heard a lot, there's been attempts at mercury and selenium, biocriteria has been on the table for many years, sediment criteria has been out there, but not a lot of work, I think, has been done, and not a lot of information has been promulgated at a national level to the regions, to the states, to local communities on how to adapt to site-specific conditions. And, you know, I guess that's a comment, and I see this with, you know, there's technologies and other stuff. The Criterion Standards Program, particularly as it relates to metals and metals contamination, is a real interest, and it's something we deal with on a day-to-day basis. So is there any effort, I think, to go back and look at a lot of these criteria that really drive a lot of the decision-making, both in terms of new mines as well as remediation of old mines, and whether we're really getting the most bang for the buck in terms of, you know, what treatment technologies, what remediation we do, and those aspects of it.
Okay. I will try. I'll throw in 2 cents on this issue, and hopefully others can weigh in as well. I guess one point that I would make, and yesterday Dr. Sutherland from my office gave a presentation, and if there's one thing you kind of take away from that when she started talking about standards and criteria, is that we live in an environment now where it is very difficult to get new science out on the street and have it be used. There are tremendous public policy debates that surround any new standard that we try to advance. And she was talking about, for example, about the challenge of EPA working on dioxin standards and TCE standards. But if you look at the discussions about nutrient and water quality in the Everglades, or if you look at the discussions about water quality related to coal mining in Appalachia, or you look at the challenges of interpreting toxicology information. These kinds of debates and this science debate, they're very difficult because you encounter a confluence between a science debate and a lot of interested parties on the outside that see changing standards as a threat. And so, it has been very difficult for, I think, many entities to kind of get the latest science out on the street and in use. Of course, I think what I observe, at least this is in the U.S., that
A lot of state water quality standards have a big impact, and in our law we have a, you know, in CERCLA we defer to those kinds of standards. So you know, it's not just federal standard setting. I'm sure in countries around the world you find that you have standard setting occurring at the federal level, but at local at more local levels as well, and this adds to some complexity. So it's just very tough getting this work done, having worked on trying to get new standards and numbers out, that sort of thing. We have a question up here as well.
Paul McCandle, University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom. I think there's a difference between getting the science out into the world at large, and we call that peer-reviewed publications, and then embedding that into your standards. And the EPA is no different to any other governmental organization around the world. Because of the need to consult with your fellow departments and other agencies, you take a long time to get to the position of putting an EPA seal on the science that we in the universities produce and many other institutions produce. Is the solution, therefore, to take the numerical aspects of the standards out and have performance-based standards that allow the latest knowledge to be applied, which I think is what the gentleman was really making the point of? 10 years ago, I started using bioavailability in human health risk assessment in the UK, using tests that were published and developed here in the States. In my naivety, I thought that you guys were doing that routinely, and so therefore I was kind of piggybacking on to what was going on in the States. I only later found out that actually they weren't allowed to use that scientific knowledge in risk assessments for quite a long time. And so maybe the concept of a standard as being the seal of scientific approval needs to be changed so that we can work with the latest knowledge from anywhere around the world as it develops.
I'd like to continue that a little further. I understand the issues, unfortunately, about getting science on the streets and how difficult it is, but at a more practical, on-the-street level, what do you recommend to get innovative technologies and approaches at full scale, at remediation or mine openings? We've been able to do it as a company in oil and gas, but it's very difficult within the mining industry. And I think you'll find that there are technologies out there that will be very cost effective.
I guess what I would say on the innovative technology front, I have to just admit I'm not exactly up on the particular issue you're alluding to and maybe you could explain it a little bit further so I just have a little bit more context. And I wonder if Kelly would be in a better position to kind of speak to this, since this. I mean, are there regulatory dimensions to this that add difficulty, or?
Right.
I think
you highlight probably a difference between the mining industry and the oil and gas industry, where I think the large mining companies are much more conservative by nature than some of the wildcatting folks in the oil and gas industry. So I think maybe we're sometimes followers rather than innovators. But I do see, you know, it does take time to get into the large organizations, but it gets there. With respect to getting it through government, you know, we support the ITRC, the Interstate, what that stands for, Technical Regulatory Council, which is right now vetting a number of technologies and trying to get more awareness within the states of what's viable and what's innovative, and that it can work by doing case studies. We've had a case study done at our site on some of our technologies, and support them. I think Cheryl's here, and she's quite involved in that. So.
Yeah, and I would say, just, you know, I mean, as a very general matter, we have a, as part of my office, we have a technology innovation program, and we, I mean, one of the roles that we try to play in that program is to help with these particular kinds of issues. So I guess what I would offer you, because I find these, I mean, I'm not sure what the general regulatory climate is or the general commentary is on this, but if there is a specific technology that you think is useful in a particular application, and if we could be of any help in kind of explaining that or articulating that, we, you know, our technology innovation folks kind of have an, you know, open arm to that kind of new thinking, and would be happy to you know, sit down and talk with you about the specifics and you know, see if there's anything we could do to help out the particular situation that you have.
Let's see, this is Randy Wenzel, exponent, retired EPA person. Just wanted to respond back to the criteria issue. Some ways the glass is half full. I know the EPA Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response has a bioavailability work group that is open for new methods and is evaluating new processes and dealing with metals, and that is certainly an open group that is active. Office of Water has performed a nice partnership with academics and industry on developing biological ligand models that are useful for copper, and those have been, I think, put into regulations, and those are state-of-the-art methods, too. So I think there's some areas where the EPA has partnered or is willing to partner with academics or industry on advancing metal techniques and methods for criteria.
Thank you. I'm following the cues that we're down to our last minute or so. Is there any last question before we move on to the next part of our program? Very good. I guess one observation is obviously we started with a series of talks that were presented at very broad 10,000-foot level, but I think as we learned in the last 2 days in talking among our government officials, these are very important contexts for the technical work that goes on at mining sites, at all land remediation sites as well. So as we look to our breakout sessions today, please keep in mind the social and economic issues that we've heard today, and the tensions that sometimes exist between the groups that come together to accomplish cleanups of these very difficult sites. At this point, I'd like to introduce Carlos Pichon. He's also with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. He's been a driving force for green and sustainable remediation practices in our program, and he'll be introducing our breakout sessions for the rest of the day. Thanks.
Thank you, Bruce. And for those of you on the Internet, we're closing out that portion now. And for everybody, please note that at the URL for this workshop, www.miningworkshop.org, where the agenda is, after the conference, we will be posting all the presentations, and we will be archiving the netcast, the audio of this opening plenary. So keep that URL in your favorites. We'll not be breaking out. Well, first we have a break. So when we do break, be sure to get a cup of coffee. And then the posters will be here. Take a chance to speak with the presenters and come around the posters and the folks that are presenting them and have a conversation with them. For the breakouts, as you see in the yellowish tan paper, we have three sessions, three parallel tracks in rooms 5, 6, and 7 here all around the corner here. The first one is building sustainability into mining site remediation. It's going to be moderated by my boss, so I'm sure it's going to be really well moderated, J.F. Heimerman. The second track is innovations in mining site remediation technologies, and that's going to be moderated by Dave Reisman of our EPA's Office of Research and Development. We had the benefit of two of EPA's three top mining guys. One of them is Dave Reisman. He'll be moderating that other session. Session C in room 7, salon 7, also around the corner, is engaging communities in remediation and reuse decisions. And Cole Molinar from the Ministry of Housing, Spatial Planning, and Environment of the Netherlands. He came all the way from the Netherlands just to moderate this track. He'll be moderating that third track. And all of them have 6 speakers. If you look at the agenda, a rich mix of folks representing many different perspectives. And we tried to balance it both geographically as well as, you know, within the group, the different sectors that they might represent. So I know these are going to be very interesting sessions. They are very tight. So we have asked our moderators and we ask our speakers to stay on time. The idea is that you can switch between rooms if you want to hear different talks that are in different tracks. So moderators know that. Speakers, please beware. And if you are going to move between rooms, try to do it quickly. Fortunately, they're all right next to each other. There's very little time for questions. We did pack a lot into this day. That's on purpose. I know it looks like we're an overboard. But we have reserved 45 minutes from 2:30 to 3:15. So do ask the speakers that you stick around till that period of time. And for those of you, if you have a clarification question during the sessions themselves, feel free to ask it, and the moderators will be there to help take care of that. If you have more of a discussion, don't forget it. Jot it down. Bring it with you to the breakout sessions. To the Q and answer sessions at 2:30 to 3:15. Then at the end of the day at 3:45, the moderators will be reporting out in a plenary form. They'll give a quick summary of what was discussed in each of the tracks, some of the key points that were made, et cetera. So the closing should be pretty interesting. If you missed any of the other tracks, we know there's a lot of good stuff. Unfortunately, we have to do all this in one day. We could have do it over 3 days, and that's why we have three tracks. But at the end of the day, you will have the benefit of hearing a summary report out of what was discussed in the different tracks. So with that, I won't hold you up any longer.
I'd like to thank our plenary speakers here one last time for an excellent round of presentations here.
If you're still with us online, please go to slide 39. There's a link there to fill out the feedback form for today's presentation, and we appreciate all the time and your patience in staying with us during this live event. And once again, thank you. And you can look for this podcast on CLUIN in about 2 weeks. Thank you. Bye.